Thank you all. Please be seated. This is a time set for oral argument in our case number CACR 250292, State of Arizona versus Adam Daniel Flower. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for oral argument. If appellant wishes to reserve a portion of that argument, you're free to do so, but you need to keep track of your own time at the podium clock. Out of respect for counsel and to avoid any embarrassment, I would ask that everyone check to make sure your cell phones are off. We've read the briefs. We've conferenced the case. We'd encourage you to keep that in mind as you present oral argument today. Our proceedings are being recorded and then posted to YouTube, so please, as you begin your presentation, start by telling us your name and the party that you represent. And with that, Ms. Reller, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Kristen Reller on behalf of Adam Flower. I'll endeavor to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal and we'll keep track of my time. The answer to this court's jurisdiction question is dispositive. In 2025, the Superior Court did not have jurisdiction to order restitution and the order is void. In 2020, the sentencing court held restitution open for 6 months to the extent that restitution was at issue. That reservation of restitution authority expired on August 28th of 2020.
What if somebody came in the day after that and said, oh, sorry, I missed this by a day. Here's my restitution amount.
In this particular case, the reservation of restitution authority is what defined the scope of the restitution obligation. So in this particular case, on 6 months and 1 day, that restitution authority had expired, and jurisdiction under 13805A could no longer reach that reservation of restitution authority. And that's specifically because 13805A is specific to extending restitution jurisdiction beyond sentencing for the purpose of ordering, modifying, or enforcing the manner of court-ordered payments, or in A2, specific to restitution. But again, the operative language is order, modifying, and enforcing the manner of payment for the restitution obligation.
What's your strongest case supporting the argument you just made?
So I think it would be a combination. I think Bartlett, which I recognize is an unpublished case from this court from 2025, but that's also in concert with Ames. This court in Ames had a comparison of the authority under 13603C compared to the jurisdiction under 805. And that comparison is important because it distinguishes authority from jurisdiction. And again, that's operative here.
I'm just a little bit puzzled by, we all seem to agree that the court can say, I'm going to hold restitution open for 6 months. But it's weird. So the court can just say jurisdiction. We can even you can say, I'm going to hold it open for 2 years past the issuance of a mandate. It's weird that jurisdiction is not tied in any way to the mandate. You could, in your view, is it okay to say I'm going to hold jurisdiction open for 2 years?
This court's jurisprudence says that that's allowed, and that's through the extension of 13603C. This court has found that if the court reserves that authority under 603C, it is then allowed to operate on that authority beyond sentencing. That is what the case law says. Do I believe that's maybe an extension too far? Yes. However, consistent with what this court's jurisprudence, we still prevail, and that's because The jurisprudence that's come through from this court is that the amount may later be determined, but court-ordered financial obligation must be created at sentencing, and the reservation of restitution authority is sufficient to create that obligation. That's been consistent through from Holguin, Pinto, Zaputo, through Morgan, Bartlett, and Ames. And so that's been consistent throughout. And the one thing that's unifying there is whether or not that obligation, for example, in Morgan was an indefinite reservation of restitution authority. And this court found that there was no problem with that under 13603. But what's an important distinction between Morgan and this case is that it was indefinite. There was no expiration. And at the point where it expired here on August 28th of 2020, that obligation was complete and finished. There was nothing that was ordered. There was no extension requested. And at the point where that reservation of authority had expired, restitution jurisdiction under 805 can no longer reach back and touch that obligation. It was expired.
In Morgan, was there, I apologize for just pre-associating here, but was there ongoing restitution expenses that were being incurred, or was that a reason for holding it open?
Yes. So Morgan was, there was a sexual assault victim, and the state posited that that victim may want to seek counseling in the future. Given the age and circumstances of the person, that was maybe not happening at the time, but they wanted the court to keep that authority open so that if counseling costs were requested in the future, they could still be awarded.
Whereas here, all of the expenses that were submitted were ones that were known of at the time the 6 months elapsed.
Absolutely. By the time sentencing occurred in this case, all of the costs had been incurred, to the best of my recollection.
Does the fact that that there was an intervening change in the law make any difference? At the time that your client was sentenced, it was thought that GEI defendants were not subject to receiving restitution. That law changed a few years later. Does that change the calculus in your view at all?
It doesn't, because it's not able to change the operative text of 805. And what's important, although 805 has been interpreted broadly to expand jurisdiction, not limit it, it is still confined to its text. And something that the state pointed out was actually that 805 has been amended both in 2012 and 2017. And in both of those amendments, despite this court's interpretation of the manner language in Pinto, which was from 1994, the legislature retained the manner language. Although in 2012, they added ordering and enforcing, but they still did not remove the manner language. And then when they added A2 in 2017, they mirrored A1 for restitution. So again, it was operative. It still has to be tied to something that was ordered previously. And the manner is what's the operative language. That's important because if we actually look back at 804, throughout 804, the manner is actually used in multiple provisions. So specifically, if you look at 804E, G, H3, and M, they all refer to the manner, which clearly shows that it is distinct. The manner is distinct from the act of determining and ordering restitution. And because this is the only statute that would extend restitution jurisdiction beyond sentencing, we have to give the text its meaning. There's no reason that we can move beyond that, and it's pretty clear the legislature intended it to be that way.
Counsel, do I hear you right in saying that the controlling entity or provision in when restitution must be sought is when the judge at sentencing says it's closed?
That creates the bounds of the obligation created, yes. And so
if, let me follow up with a hypothetical. Here we have 6 months and the claim for restitution here was made far after that. But what if instead the court said, I'm leaving restitution open?
So that's a fact pattern this court has come across before, for example, in Morgan. I also believe Zaputo from 08 also had no deadline imposed. And in those particular instances, the court found that the restitution obligation had been created. The facts of those cases are important. In Zaputo, restitution was stipulated to in the plea agreement, but it wasn't ordered. The amount wasn't determined or ordered at sentencing. However, the court explicitly retained jurisdiction and imposed no deadline. And again, like we've discussed in Morgan, the court retained an open-ended restitution authority. But that's not what happened in this case. The court limited it to 6 months.
And I understand that, and that's why it's a hypothetical.
Yes.
But what if, again, to further the hypothetical, a defendant is sentenced for some offense that is subject to a restitutionary award when the defendant's 20, and the court says, I'm leaving restitution open, and when the defendant, as a person of a certain age myself, turns 64, suddenly there's a claim for restitution. Does the court retain jurisdiction some 44 years later, from your perspective, to issue a restitution award?
This court's jurisprudence would say yes. However, I think that you're finding the problem that the jurisprudence has created, which allows this kind of open-ended restitution obligation to interfere with finality. Although 13805 does have the limits of either until the obligation is satisfied or the sentence is complete, again, if the obligation was created, it would still be open in that particular instance, which I guess is probably maybe where this court should make a change in that open-ended reservations of restitution authority are not sufficient to create an obligation.
That's what prompts my question, because I think at the core we were asked to interpret and apply statutory language, which we did not craft, to facts that are presented to us, and that's routinely, I suppose, what we're asked to do appropriately. But that's why I wondered from your perspective if there is an outer boundary, if a court says instead of this, I'm just retaining jurisdiction over restitution and downs his or her pen.
In accordance with this court's jurisprudence, that would be allowed. But I think that's where we have a problem. And I think if we want to be strict textualists and look at 805's operative text exclusively, it would have to be court-ordered payment, as in something that was already ordered that must be paid. So if we want to maybe disagree with this court's line of cases and be more strict adherence to the text, those open-ended restitution obligations would be insufficient to create the obligation. But again, in this particular case, you don't have to reach that.
But I would agree. I mean, if we agree with you on how to interpret 805, the problem that we have is 13603 that's just silent on when the award has to be imposed. It seems to make sense to say that if all of the damages have been incurred, they should be ordered at the time of sentencing. Might be, I guess, a rule but that's not what we have. So that's what I guess my struggle is a little bit more with 603 than with 805. If there is authority, it would be a very easy case if the court just said you waited too long, I gave you 6 months, and they said no, but here the court let them do it. Is that a discretionary call on the part of the court under 603?
This court has found yes. 603 is what provides the court the authority to award restitution. However, the court's authority is always constrained by its jurisdiction, which would be set by the Constitution statutes. And so we do have 603 and 805 could be read as in conflict or in concert with each other, which is that, yes, the court has the authority to do so, but it is a limited authority. And I think that that would be consistent with this court's holdings in Bartlett, but then also in Knuckles, which found that although restitution is a right of a constitutional magnitude, it's not an absolute right. And this court has found limits to that particular right. In Knuckles, it was a procedural rule that wasn't followed, and the court found that because they didn't act within the timeline set by the Superior Court, it was waived. And then also in Bartlett, which, again, I recognize it's unpublished authority, but the facts of Bartlett are particularly unique in that we actually do have the expiration of a sentence prior to the imposition of a restitution obligation. And in that case, the court found that jurisdiction had expired. So although 603 provides broad authority, and this court and the Arizona Supreme Court have found that 603 is very broad, it's not limitless. The text supports limits to 603.
Counsel, could I get you, time goes quickly, could I get you to turn to the types of restitution that were awarded here? It strikes me that they're kind of, they fall into a lot of buckets, but kind of two. Some travel-related expenses and then some kind of insurance recovery-related expenses, my terms, not the parties. Do you view those similarly or differently if the court had jurisdiction to impose a restitutionary award here?
They are different, but neither can be recovered in this case for different reasons. So what we've kind of all collectively referred to as the consultant fees, those cannot be recovered because they are consequential, because the meddling of State Farm is an intervening cause that disrupts causation. And in awarding those fees, the Superior Court was holding Mr. Flower responsible for State Farm's actions. And then on the flip side, we do recognize that the plane ticket and the mileage, those are recognized economic losses. However, those can't be recovered because it'd be a due process violation to modify Mr. Flower's sentence 5 years after the fact, given that Gilpin was neither expected, nor was it defensible given the law at the time.
But if those had been asserted within 6 months, you would not dispute that they would be recoverable.
We would dispute that they're recoverable because I believe the due process issue would prevail above jurisdiction. So even if this court does find that there's jurisdiction, restitution can't be awarded in this case because of the due process violation.
What's the due process if the court says I'm holding this open for 6 months? Is there a problem with what we're not able to effectively counter what the victims are asserting? What would be the due process violation there?
So at the point where restitution was left open in this case, the state had asked to keep restitution open. At no point did they submit a request, nor did the victims submit a request at sentencing.
My hypothetical is they submit it 4 months later. Would you be objecting to the imposition of the travel expenses?
Had it been imposed in 2020, it would have violated Hartfield. And so we would have had a Hartfield problem, and they could have litigated just like the parties did in Gilpin, they could have litigated whether or not a GEI adjudication is considered a conviction. That didn't happen here. So that would have been dependent on that particular conflict. But at the point where Gilpin is the basis now for the parties coming forward and seeking restitution, that's what violates due process, because we can't retroactively apply Gilpin to Mr. Flower, because at the time he was adjudicated in 2020, Hartfield was fully settled. It was not, there was no doctrinal drift. It hadn't been called
but
into question.
Gilpin was decided 4 months before the 6 month period. Would that be a problem?
We would still have a retroactivity problem, because the bottom of the retroactivity issue is fair warning. And at the time that Mr. Flower's commitment and the consequences of his adjudication were imposed in 2020, in February of 2020, he was explicitly told by the court under Hartfield, restitution can't be awarded here. Had the court come back?
Well, the court said some things like that, but the court also kept restitution open.
And no one took advantage of that opportunity.
And I understand that. But in Judge Catani's hypothetical world, I guess what I think about with the due process notice is I could have and would have done something differently. And I'm not sure from the defendant's perspective what would have happened differently. This was not a plea. This was not a capped plea. This was not a whole bunch of things that you might be able to appoint to and say, hey, I did this because I thought restitution was a dead letter. That's not what happened.
There's a couple of different components to the answer to that question. So the first is that the fair warning doesn't require proof of actual reliance. Fair warning has always been an objective test. So we don't have to prove that Mr. Flower knew that he wouldn't be subject to restitution, and that's why he pursued a GEI defense. Rather, at bottom, Mr. Flower was charged with a criminal offense, went to trial, bench trial nevertheless, but asserted the available defense to which he had a right to assert. That doesn't prove any sort of reliance on Hartfield, nor does it have to. The other thing I think is important is if we look at the really specific language, and I reviewed it this morning just to make sure we're clear, so that at sentencing, the state said, we'd like to keep restitution open so we can gather documentation. The court then says, no, I don't think restitution is appropriate here. The state then framed its request in the alternative and said, well, like, if it ever becomes a problem, because we know that Mr. Flower will be in the state hospital, can we just get a waiver of his presence if that ever happens? There seems to have been discussion with Victims Council about the basis for why restitution couldn't be ordered. And then only then did the court say, looking at what the parties had said, at the point where this becomes a problem, if it becomes an issue, it has to be done within 6 months. And nothing ever happened there. I do see I'm running low on time. I'd like to reserve my time. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. Kenney, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I want to go back to the very beginning and talk about jurisdiction. So Flower focuses on the manner of payment, and if you look in the Cervantes case, which he cites in his supplemental brief, the defendant there made a similar argument and said that 805A limits the trial court's post-sentence jurisdiction to order modified and enforced only the way restitution payments are made. Although he didn't say manner, he said the way. And if you look at paragraphs 8, 12, and 13, this court implicitly rejected that argument. In paragraph 12, the court found that by enacting 805A, the legislature provided continuing jurisdiction to regulate the payment of restitution until the debt satisfied or the incarceration or probation is completed. That says nothing about just the manner. It says paying restitution. In paragraph 13, this court stated that nothing
You could look to the language of the statute, though. I guess I'm having a hard time reading 805 as saying anything other than for purposes of ordering, modifying, and enforcing the manner in which. So what does order, modify, and enforce it? You're saying that doesn't modify the term manner, the manner in which restitution is paid?
I do agree that the three operative verbs go modify manner, but in 2012, order was added to 13805A. So if it just regulated manner, then I don't think 805A would have been added because, and then in 2017, it was modified again.
Wouldn't they have said ordering restitution as opposed to, it's ordering the manner in which court ordered payments are made. Doesn't that contemplate there's already been a restitution award and we're just ordering how they're going to be paid?
I don't believe so, because if it just wanted to just address manner, I mean, I guess theoretically they could have,
enforcing would take care of ordering?
No, I think ordering was an intentional choice. It's separate, and it was added in 2012 to expand what the trial court could do. Going back to Cervantes in paragraph 13, it says, nothing in the text of the statute supports the proposition that 805 limits the authority to award restitution. It doesn't address just manner. It says awarding it, so you can order it or award it in the first instance. In State versus...
When was it ordered in Cervantes?
The facts of that case support the state's position rather than Mr. Flower's position. Their restitution was ordered initially. The victim's medical treatment was ongoing, and the trial court didn't set a deadline for additional restitution requests. The state submitted its request while the defendant was still serving his sentence. The same facts are true here. Although there wasn't an initial award of restitution, the defendant is still serving his sentence at the state hospital when the court ordered jurisdiction. Or ordered the restitution award.
I'm sorry, what was the original? I apologize, we can read the cases ourselves, but the original order, it said I'm awarding restitution and left it open?
I don't believe it left it open. I believe it just ordered restitution for part of the victim's medical expenses. There, I believe it was a fight with lots of people involved, and the victim had a lot of medical expenses.
It didn't say anything about ongoing expenses.
No, and in State versus Jackson, also cited in our brief, the trial court didn't state that it continued jurisdiction indefinitely. It didn't give a deadline, but this court found jurisdiction because the sentence hadn't expired. And I think the same is true here. Even though there was a deadline, timeliness is separate from jurisdiction, and the victim's restitution wasn't paid in full. Flower is still at the state hospital, so this court does have jurisdiction under 805A.
So under your theory, you could wait 20 years, 30 years, bring a restitution claim. Is there any limit to when you can bring a restitution claim?
For victims, only until the payment is made in full under A2.
But nothing's been ordered. So I'm saying there hasn't been a restitution award made yet. So it's not payment. Sure, if there's a restitution amount for $2 million and it hasn't been paid, everybody agrees that you have jurisdiction for as long as and until it's paid. But you haven't set a restitution amount yet. Is there any limit as to when you can come in and say, I'm entitled to a restitution award?
Under the plain language of the statute, I think the limit is if the defendant is still serving his sentence. So
Which statute are you referring to when you say under the language of the statute there?
13805A1.
But so lifetime probation, that means you could wait as long as the guy's alive, the defendant, presuming it's a man, you can come in and say, I want restitution. Even when the restitution amount that you're seeking was known to you at the time of sentencing, you can wait 40 years down the road and come in and make a claim for restitution?
Well, I think there's two components to that. There's a timeliness component and a jurisdictional component. 805A1, the jurisdiction component, is whether or not the defendant is serving his sentence. The timeliness requirement, I think there's a confluence of factors to look at. Was there a deadline imposed? Was there ongoing medical expenses, like in State versus Howard? So if the defendant is still on probation, it could happen. But I do want to go back to something that I think kind of gets lost, is that the standard of proof at a restitution hearing is preponderance of the evidence. So let's say, you know, they go to a hearing and the trial court thinks that, okay, you submit a request for medical expenses 6 years later, and then, you know, how do I know this wasn't attributable to a car accident versus, you know, the fight that you got into? I think the victims still have to prove their underlying request, and then it goes back to the harm caused by the defendant.
Sure, and that's applying, you know, the rules of engagement, rules not of evidence, but rules of proof that apply to a restitution claim. If in hypothetical, same facts that we have here, except the trial court says, nope, the request is too late. In this instance, the four-year delay, even with the change in law, is too late. Is there an appeal to be had in that?
Yes, under 1340.32, if the victims wanted to.
Let me ask a better question. Is there a valid appeal to be had? And if so, what's the standard that this court would apply when the court says you waited too long?
I believe it would be, well, it depends on if, you know, the victims object. If they object at the hearing and say, you know, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. I do think it's timely. And I think it's timely because the change in the law, Gilpin overruling Hartfield, is good cause. And the trial court says, I disagree. I think there is jurisdiction for the state to appeal that. And I think it would be an abuse of discretion about whether, you know, that's a good cause or not. And I would argue that a change in the law that's been valid for 24 years is good cause.
And I understand there'd be arguments to be had, but at your point that it's an abuse of discretion standard, it really rests with the trial court in his or her discretion and ensuring that that's not exercised unreasonably. Is that your position?
Yes. And here, I don't think that the trial court acted unreasonably. The court found that the request was timely. It was submitted 2 months after Gilpin was decided. And I would note, I know I noted this very briefly in my supplemental brief, is that any timeliness argument has been waived. The defense could have objected and said, you know, this was past the six-month deadline. They didn't do that. That's been waived. Resolving that would violate the party presentation principle. So really, we're just looking at jurisdiction. And for the arguments I cited earlier, I do think the court has jurisdiction.
And counsel, let me ask you on the party presentation principle. On occasion, we see issues that the parties don't. And in those occasions, sometimes we direct supplemental briefing like we have. Is that a violation of the party presentation principle, in your opinion?
Respectfully, I would say yes, because it's up to the parties.
Aren't we charged with getting it right?
This court is charged with getting it right, but the court decides claims presented by the parties, and here Flowers did not present that claim. So I will say that in the two cases that have decided party presentation, it's whether or not the two factors the Supreme Court looked at was whether or not it was presented by the party and whether or not the state had a chance to respond. So arguably one of those conditions was met because we were given a supplemental briefing order, but he never brought it up in his opening brief. Under Carver, this court's jurisprudence, if you don't bring something up in your opening brief, it's waived.
But you agree on, if it's a jurisdictional issue, we can raise that at any time. And if,
in fact, aren't we charged with doing that by case law from our Supreme Court?
Yes, I would agree with that. You know, either side, if, you know, either side had a valid constitutional concern, if there's not jurisdiction, that doesn't really matter. And I do agree that this court has to look de novo to whether or not there's jurisdiction. So I want to go back to the first issue in the briefing, the consequential damages. And Flower focuses too heavily on the additional intervening factors language and sort of ignores the first part of it concerning the defendant's actions. So in Wilkinson, at paragraph 14, the Supreme Court agreed with the dissent from the from this court's opinion that although breaking a window is not an element of the crime of burglary, a burglar may be required to pay restitution for a window he breaks when entering because his criminal conduct directly caused that damage. So there in Wilkinson, contracting without a license had nothing to do with his damages.
But don't you have to pay damages to the person who's out of pocket?
Yes, and here...
But well, he isn't... Here the victim's not out of pocket. It's if the insurance company were filing a claim, that would make sense that that's a direct cost. But let's say the insurance company had filed a claim and said we paid $4,000, the homeowner paid $1,000, but then we also litigated over who was going to pay that, and there was another $10,000 of litigation expenses. Is the defendant on the hook for what the insurance company paid, what the homeowner paid, and for their litigation expenses?
So in thinking through this and preparing for it, I don't think the litigation expenses would be, and trying to think about a limiting principle. So here, the victim's actual losses was the $10,000 and some change paid to the insurance consultants. Theoretically, the insurance company could pursue a restitution claim against...
Wouldn't they have a bad faith insurance claim? Isn't that independent of what harm the defendant caused?
Yes, I agree. And I think that's the limiting principle is, let's say, considering the insurance claim, they just completely denied it in bad faith, and the victims had to initiate a completely separate legal proceeding in civil claim for bad faith, or what other claims are not familiar with civil cases. But let's say that there is a completely separate proceeding from the insurance claim and the criminal conduct. I do think that would be consequential damages. And so in looking at this issue, I kind of tried to look at it from the forest and the trees perspective. From the forest, you're looking at the insurance claim. Was this directly caused by his conduct? Yes. And so when you need to hire a professional to help you with something, so a probate attorney, a funeral home, you need something at that initial step that is restitution. But then looking at the...
You only need that if there's bad faith on the part of the insurance company. Isn't that... Shouldn't an insurance company pay? Your window's broken. Shouldn't they come in and pay for it?
In a perfect world, yes.
But why doesn't that turn it into a consequential damage? If we would just expect, at most, you're going to have to pay the cost of the window. You seem, because if the insurance company came in and said, yeah, we paid this amount, it seems like they'd be entitled to it. But I don't know how you get that there's somehow an expectation that we're going to have to litigate something, and that's also a direct cause of the defendant's actions.
Well, litigation in a civil proceeding is separate from the harm. That's solely based on bad faith.
And how's that different from here, where they're essentially trying to avoid litigation? They're hiring someone to try to get the insurance company to do what they think they're required to do.
So I go back to Spears and Reed. Spears was the case that said victims can hire a probate attorney to help them, the probate process. In Reed, our Supreme Court said that you can hire a victim's attorney when reasonably necessary. And if you look at paragraph 28 in Reed, it talks about the victim's attorney was looking at social media posts that he had possibly sent the victim, and this could have possibly violated his release conditions. And our Supreme Court said that that could be justifiable, such as if the attorney had to involve himself in the matter, for example, the prosecutor was unwilling or unavailable to enforce the victim's rights. So if in that instance, if you just look at the causal factors, then that would be consequential. But the Supreme Court gave that as guidance to where this could be proper restitution if it's reasonably necessary to remedy a harm caused by the victims. So in that instance,
I'm still puzzled by it. It's reasonably necessary. Somebody breaks, it's not a criminal act, but just a kid hits a baseball through my window. It's reasonably necessary to hire somebody to try to figure out whether the insurance company should pay for that window?
I think it goes to the individual facts of the case. So if they paid the insurance claim right away, then the victims wouldn't have an economic loss, and the insurance company could go and seek restitution for the $500 or whatever it costs to replace the window. But here, looking at what the victims' actual losses were and what they were out of pocket, they had to hire someone that was reasonably necessary based on the defendant's own expert's testimony.
Well, but also based on the conduct of State Farm, right? I mean, isn't it that the need for these additional employees was caused not by the conduct of the defendant in this case, but by the way that State Farm adjusted the loss? The amount of damage didn't change. The cost to repair the damage didn't change. It was State Farm's conduct in refusing to cover the damage that necessitated these additional expenses. Isn't that true?
It's a factor, but I don't think it's the dispositive factor. So let's play with the facts a little bit here. State Farm gave an initial $19,000 disbursement. Let's say that happened and the victims were like, you know what, I don't want to hire these individual consultants. I'm just going to go hire a general contractor to finish painting, putting carpet in, whatever they needed. Those expenses would no doubt be restitution because it's still processing the damage that his conduct caused.
Right, but so, those expenses are incurred for repairs for the damage that was caused. This is not that. This is, I'm hiring experts to fight with my insurance company about the repairs that they refused to pay for.
And I think under Spears and Reed, you need to look at whether or not it was reasonably necessary and whether it was contrary to custom. And based on Delgado's testimony, this is very common in the insurance community. It's even common that the insurance company can give you an initial lowball offer. That's low first-party coverage when that happens, and that the insurance company is open and willing to pay additional amounts. The same three professionals that the victims hired, he said, was very routine. He was very familiar with the entire process. And so looking at the pushback that the victims were getting and looking at that language, I do think it was reasonably necessary in this instance to hire those professionals.
Am I misremembering? Didn't the court say, well, the overall damage was $60,000? It's still less than that. Wasn't that the court's rationale?
Yes, and I will say that the court's reasoning could have been a little better, maybe a little bit more thorough.
You would agree
but
that that's just flat out wrong. That that's not if because the insurance company would have a restitution claim if there were no dispute with the homeowner, and the total amount of damages was $50,000. The insurance company would be entitled to collect whatever they paid on that, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
It seems to turn it into something other than direct damages. It's the insurance company's unwillingness to do what they were supposed to do, which it turns it from being a direct to a consequential damage. It's not. It's still a damage. The victim still has been damaged, but it's been caused. There's been an intervening action by someone, which makes it a consequential damage rather than a direct damage.
But I think focusing too heavily on that, in one case that I want to sort of show illustrates how far this can go down and what it would take for consequential damages is I go back to State versus Sexton. There, the trial court ordered restitution for any uncovered insurance expenses because the victims lost their coverage. And the court said that, if they seek restitution and it's ordered, it's because the defendant damaged the house and because the victim's insurance company elected to cancel the policy and because no other insurance company would issue a comparable and because they engaged in some negligent act causing a third party to file a claim and, you know, so on and so forth. And so there's a lot of steps removed. And then even looking at Lindsley and Madrid, and there it was restitution over the victims, whether it was lost wages or travel expenses to attend the court hearing. The court looked at the overall criminal proceeding, and because of the defendant's actions, the victim were unavoidably intertwined. In Madrid, the court said the necessity of the trial was entirely a direct consequence of the murder. So if you look so much at the intervening cause and kind of forget the outside big picture, I mean, the trial theoretically could be an intervening cause because the factor there could be, well, the defendant decided to go to trial instead of take a plea agreement.
But that's the defendant's action, not a third party.
But I think that
The defendant can fairly understand that by taking this action or by taking it to trial, I may increase the amount of restitution that's awarded against me. What control did Mr. Flower have over the conduct of State Farm and how they adjusted this claim?
He didn't have any control over that, but I don't think the defendant being able to control something really governs that analysis.
It goes to whether it's a direct cause. If the victim's car breaks down and they have it going to the courthouse, but for having to go to trial, my car wouldn't have broken down on the highway. You could make that argument, and that would seem nonsensical to say that that's a direct cause that was directly caused by the defendant. It's not a but-for analysis. You would agree with that?
No, I agree. But I think it's still I'll wrap up really quickly. I still think it's not to lose sight of what the harm caused by the defendant's conduct. And then looking at the factor, Reed and Spears says that you look to see if it's reasonably necessary. And here are the facts of the case. I believe it is. If I may just make one quick request, and I'm happy to cede extra time. I would just request, I know that this division doesn't ask whether cases should be published, and I've actually never made this request, but both parties relied on mem decisions in the supplemental briefing order. So I would just ask this court to consider publishing, you know, whoever wins, just at least on the jurisdiction issue. And I would ask the court to affirm the order.
Thank you, Ms. Kinney. Ms. Reller, rebuttal.
Thank you. Because jurisdiction is a threshold matter, I'll start there. The state argues that because Mr. Flower is still serving his sentence, 805 still reaches him for restitution jurisdiction. However, the state's syllogism is missing a major part. The major premise is that A1 retains jurisdiction until a sentence expires. The sentence here is not expired, so then the conclusion is that jurisdiction exists to order restitution. However, the clause about the sentence not being expired is a clause that only fixes the temporal endpoint of retained jurisdiction. It's a measure of duration. It doesn't define the scope of the jurisdiction authority.
Sorry to interrupt, but opposing counsel said the word ordering was added later. What's your response to that? Why add the word ordering if it just means kind of working out the details of how you're paying something?
I have three responses. We'll see if I can get through all of them. So the first would be that although the legislature modified the statute at that time, they didn't remove the manner language. The second would be that ordering, modifying, enforcing are a parallel construction that are meant to be interpreted together. The third would be that if you were to read ordering the way the state asks you to, you have to actually ignore a significant text of the statute, and you actually then have to read ordering separate from modifying and enforcing. And that would bring us back to point two, which is that it's a parallel construction that's meant to be interpreted together. So although it was amended, the argument, unfortunately, for them is unavailing. My second point would be to Judge Thumma's question about preservation and party presentation. The state agreed that part of the issue with preservation is whether or not it's presented and the party has an opportunity to respond. I think the actual bigger point here is, if we're looking at fundamental fairness, they had the opportunity to research, respond, and provide this court their position on those, and they did not. This court's question was broad enough. You asked us what kind of limits there were, both jurisdictionally and otherwise, indicating that otherwise was still an option for briefing. And the last piece is just to get to that consequential damages issue. Attributing all downstream costs to the original offense eliminates the requirement of direct causation, which has been a part of our jurisprudence and our statutes since we had VBR and we started looking at these things. Because there's the intervening causation of State Farm not paying out the way they were supposed to, that has broken the causation, and Mr. Flower should not be responsible for State Farm's problems. With that, we'd ask that this court please vacate the restitution order. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, we appreciate your presentation today. We appreciate your briefing, and we appreciate in particular your supplemental briefing. We've asked you to do more than you usually do, and that helps us. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a written ruling in due course. Court stands in recess.